This is Everyday Bravery, a podcast from Prudential. I'm Meg Wilcox.
So Meg, there I am working in this small TV station.
So like a local newsroom kind of thing?
Exactly. And I'm fresh out of school, so you know, I'm just trying to figure it all out.
Ah yes, the first real job.
The first real job, exactly. We're an hour before air, and one of the key anchors finally walks in the door, and he is totally, well, let's just say he's clearly incapacitated and clearly incapable of doing the show. So guess what? I'm doing the show. I get called in. I get called into the news director's office, and he's like, Aaron, this is your big break. You're going to do the show. I thought I could say no, but why would I? I mean, this was an opportunity, however terrible an opportunity it was. And I got back to my desk, and I'm sweating like crazy trying to crank out a script. This guy's trying to help me. He was useless. And he spills his entire cup of coffee all over his keyboard and all over me. So my pants that I was wearing, like, were stained as I'm about to go on air for the first time.
Oh, man.
I threw on some hideous makeup because I also didn't really know how to do that and got out onto the set. Of course, I'm like shaking as I'm holding my scripts, just thinking, oh, my God, this is it. Like, I am literally a few minutes away. I hadn't even had time to phone my mom, right? To tell my mom, like, Mom, I'm doing my first, like, ever show. And we're about a minute away from going to air, and the anchor comes sauntering over to me to give me some final words of advice. And I am not lying when I tell you that he leaned on the desk and he fell over and ended up falling behind me and the other anchor.
Oh, man.
Just as we were getting the 5-second countdown to air. So we're on air, and this guy is behind me on the floor, and that was my very first experience going live on air.
I can just imagine it, too, like being super nervous, trying to look at the prompter, like knowing there's a guy behind you. Did you get to do it again afterwards?
Oh, yeah, I got the show.
How many times have you had one of those days at work? You know, those days when you thought you had it all figured out until something comes at you from nowhere, like it did for Aaron. Jobs, they have a way of testing us. It takes courage to look for work. It takes courage to quit a job for good. Sometimes, it takes courage just to make it to the weekend. On this episode, stories from people whose jobs and career decisions called on them to dig deep and be brave. This is Everyday Bravery Goes to Work. Living up to your potential takes courage. This is Everyday Bravery, a podcast that refuses to settle for less than your best.
First thing we do is put on our life vests and we learn how to properly, you know, don a life vest, how to be safe in the water and what to do with a lifeboat and everything. And then the instructor says, okay, everyone, time to take off your life vest. We have to tread water for a minute or else you won't pass. And I break down crying and I'm like, I can't swim.
When we start a new job, we all face uncertainties, challenges, fears. But unless you're a lifeguard, a marine biologist, or, you know, a swimsuit model, overcoming a fear of water and proving you can swim is probably not a condition of your employment. Unfortunately, for Monica Ricketts, it was absolutely a job requirement. Otherwise, she'd lose the dream job she'd been wishing upon a star for since she was a little girl.
I was born in San Jose, California, and I didn't have much exposure to water at all. We were never around water, like we never went to the beach really. We were kind of indoor people. One day, I was 8 years old. My mom's friend Monica invited us over for a barbecue. I'll never forget the feeling I had of jumping off the water's edge and just having so much fun. I was just jumping in and out, and I had water wings on. And for some reason, this like feeling inside of me was like, oh, I really feel like I could do this on my own now. You know, as a child, you think that you're invincible. And so I just took them off, and I'll never forget, Monica looked at me and she's like, are you sure you're ready to take those off? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. Like, yeah, it's perfectly okay. And so I jumped in like the shallow end a couple times and it was fine. But the last time I jumped a little too far and immediately I realized I couldn't touch the bottom. I was trying to propel myself because I couldn't float because I didn't know how to swim. So here I am just like barely at the top of the water's surface and there was no hope. And so I tried like really hard to like flail my arms as high as I could, just hoping somebody would see. But it felt like I was under there forever. The very first thought I had while I was drowning was, I haven't even had my first kiss yet. And it was just such a random thought, but you know, growing up with Disney movies and being a romantic at heart, like of course that would be like the first thing. And then I started thinking about my family and my whole life was literally flashing before my eyes, like people say with near-death experiences. So finally, I accepted my fate. Okay, this is how I die. And I looked up and I saw a bright light, which was probably the sun, but imagination took over and it's like, there's heaven. And I felt a hand grab me just with a death grip. And I was like, there's God. Like it was an invitation. And so I felt this hand, it was so strong, like broke my hand and she reached into the water and like took me out. And it was Monica. And I just sat on the chair for a while with a towel around me. And I didn't say anything. I just sat in complete silence. My mom put me into swimming lessons shortly after, and I never passed. I wouldn't float. Like, my body would just freeze up, and I'd panic, and I just would sink. I grew up in constant fear. My first audition I ever did was at a high school. It was probably 2 months after I graduated for Disney Cruise Line. When I got interviewed, I asked the person, I said, do I need to know how to swim really well? They're like, oh no, you're going to have a training session where you'll only be in the water with a life vest on. You'll never have to take your life vest off. And I'm like, okay, cool. And by some miracle, I got the job. The first day we had training, it was all just in classroom. So then the second day comes along and it's at a pool. And then the instructor says, okay, everyone, time to take off your life vest. We have to tread water for a minute or else you won't pass. And I break down crying and I'm like, I can't swim. So what they had to do, that's so embarrassing. They had to tie a rope around my waist. And the instructor was above me, like on the edge of the pool, holding me up. And so as soon as I'd start to sink, he would pull me. So I would, you know, tread water for a bit and then sink. And he'd be like, okay. And he'd have to like pick me up. It is just terrifying. So finally, after an hour and a half, got up and I'm like, I need a moment. I'll never forget it. I literally dropped to my knees and I'm like, I have to float. I have to float. Like there's no time. So I like took off the rope around me. And I jump up and I touch the bottom, 15 feet of water, mind you. I push myself up and I start floating and I start talking to the woman who is in the water with me, the instructor. And I'm like, how are you today? Oh, that's great. Like, we just were talking calmly for a minute and I tread water just by being determined and like having that visual of somebody else filling this place that I've been dreaming about for years. Something I've worked hard for, had to push through so much insecurity for. And I'm like, you know, this is my time. And I've never given myself the time before. Usually I just give up and I just think about drowning and I think about falling to the bottom, but I did it. Everyone cheered. Like, I've never felt so much support in my entire life. Everyone was screaming, like, Monica, you did it. I mean, I think that's what Disney magic is. Like, that was my Disney magic moment in my life because all these people were there, a family. And it was just so supportive. That feeling has pushed me through so many difficult times in my life.
That's Monica Ricketts. She's a singer, dancer, and actor, and she's also proof that while dreams can take you pretty far, it's bravery that gets the job done. I'm Meg Wilcox, and this is Everyday Bravery. What does everyday bravery mean to you?
I guess to be brave, it means standing up for what you believe in.
Looking at your obstacle and just going for it.
Challenging yourself to be better or do better.
Going out of your comfort zone.
Being scared of something and knowing whether this is the moment to face that.
I mean, I feel like in my job, I definitely have to be brave. I'm the one that has to make the tough decisions.
But it's usually great because when you've taken that leap, you feel so good.
Some people have the kind of job that makes them seem like superheroes. The firefighter who runs into a burning building. The surgeon who spends 16 hours delicately trying to repair a damaged brain. And then there's John Turk. He's been an adventurer and writer since 1971. Before that, his career path had him moving in a very different direction. But as an adventurer, his journey has guided him through some wild stuff. Like the time he spent weeks in a sea kayak trying to cross the Arctic Sea, somewhere, way up there, near a patch of frozen land called Ellesmere Island.
We waited for 17 days to make this crux move through this very difficult passage of extremely powerful moving ice. And it's a kind of ice that crushes the big oaken ships of the British Navy in the 1900s and stuff. So you're jumping from ice floe to ice floe, and the ice is moving, and if you tip over and fall in and the ice closes in on you, it'll squash you until your eyeballs pop out.
John Turk has spent his life exploring the outdoors on a series of incredible adventures, taking on extreme challenges most of us wouldn't possibly dare try. But if we go back to the beginning of John's career, we find a moment of bravery in his life that many of us face in our own. A moment where the path that's been so clearly laid out before you, the one you've worked so hard for, suddenly seems wrong somehow. Here's John with the story of how his career took a radical turn before it even really got started.
I was a graduate student in chemistry on my PhD program. And I was close to getting my PhD. I was writing up my thesis and looking at the world of being a research chemist. And in those days, that instrument was so sensitive that every instrument in the world had to be in the basement, bolted to bedrock, under fluorescent light, 70 degrees, 70% relative humidity. And that was my world. And I had instrument time at night, and I worked all night. And then one day, it was a spring day in the Colorado Rockies. I went to school in Boulder, Colorado. And the snow had just melted off a mountain meadow. And my dog was running around the meadow, just digging holes in the earth and smelling the earth. So I started running around the meadow, sticking my nose into these holes and smelling the spring earth. It's a smell of decay. Decay is really the beginning of life. It's a cycle. You are in that cycle of dying, rebirth, growing, and it's life coming back, and that life comes into you, and you feel more alive than you've ever felt. This touched my DNA in a sense that nothing else did. And nothing else, not drinking, not partying, not riding fast motorcycles, nothing touched me in the way that smelling the spring earth did. And I know it sounds corny, you know, it's just the way it is. And then I realized that I couldn't spend my life in the chem lab, no matter how rewarding it was, and no matter how much good I could do for humanity, that I had to be true to this inner voice that spoke to me loud and clear and said, this is what you have to do. So I walked down the next morning, Monday morning, to my mentor's office, and I say, I'm going to quit. And he looked at me and he shook his head. He said, no, you can't quit. And you can't just go the rest of your life saying, well, I almost got my PhD. It's like almost climbing to the top of a mountain or almost doing anything. He says, finish your degree and then quit. So I continued being a graduate student for another 6 months or something.
Over those 6 months, that idea, the one he literally found in the dirt, it germinated and it grew.
You have a plan, you see, that you've had since you were a child. I went to a fancy prep school with George W. Bush as my classmate. I went to an Ivy League school, and you have this plan. And now, all of a sudden, you don't have a plan at all. You know, how am I going to earn a living? How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? And, yeah, this is going through my mind because I still have a choice. I could still, like, I haven't closed the door yet. And what's the alternative? Running around smelling the earth? You know, I still got to go to the grocery store kind of thing. And then finally I realized I can't refuse the call anymore. The moment I got my PhD, I had a canoe tied on the top of my car. I had the car packed for a summer's worth of canoeing in the Canadian Arctic. I walked out of my PhD exam, they all shake your hand and say, you know, congratulations, doctor. I got in the car and I drove north.
I imagine that as scary as this was, it was also really exciting.
You know, you're 27. You're just like, man, you're so relieved. I'm gonna go and I'm gonna live in a canoe for the next 3 months. I remember, you know, one time when we were lost up in the Rat River Pass and we were running out of food and stuff like that. You go, oh, my God. Maybe this wasn't such a good idea. And I didn't have any skills. I didn't know what I was doing. I was a PhD chemist, and all of a sudden I'm in a canoe and I'm up in there in the Arctic, and this was before GPSs, and we're lost and we're running out of food. And, yeah, do you get scared then? Of course. Of course, and then you settle down and you, and this starts the great process of going inside. You seek out this inner voice inside you that brings you ecstasy.
That ecstatic inner voice has guided John on many adventures since then, and he's never looked back on his decision. Well, almost never.
There was another time, a number of years later, I got a call from a professor who said, we built the instrument that you had designed. Will you come back and do the next experiment? And I almost said yes, but it was a powder snow day. I was in Telluride. It was really beautiful powder. And I just said, no, I'm going to go skiing. I'm sorry.
John Turk's latest book is called Crocodiles and Ice. He's now 71 years old and has no regrets.
Your journey is going to be different than mine because you're different than me. But there's some journey that you can take, every person can take, that will bring you to ecstasy.
Expecting the unexpected takes courage. This is Everyday Bravery, taking on life's challenges, both inside and outside your comfort zone. Algonquin Provincial Park is a very large park in Ontario, Canada. It measures roughly 3,000 square miles. Moose, black bears, beavers, wolves, and deer are just some of the many animals that call this place home. Tobin Long spent many summers working there. He'd interact with people who stopped into the Visitor Information Center. He'd help them learn about the natural features of the park and its wildlife. A highway cuts through the southern portion of Algonquin Park, and this is where something awful happened to Tobin and his friends while traveling one summer. And how Tobin handled the gruesome situation will make you wonder if, put in his shoes, you'd find the courage to do what he did.
So it's the end of a long weekend. and I'm getting a ride home from two friends. And we're actually on a two-lane highway in the middle of Algonquin Park. It's picturesque. It's got big pine trees. It's got big spruce trees and big fir trees. And it's gorgeous, and it's dusk. It's really serene and peaceful. It's the perfect end to a weekend. We're relaxing. There's music playing. And you're not really thinking about what's on the road ahead because there's really no traffic at this time of night. That's when it happened. Something small jumps out. There's an audible bang. Something flies off the front headlight and rolls into the ditch. My immediate instinct is to say to my friend Liam, "You gotta pull over." He's a little stunned, but he stops the car pretty quickly. Liam has no idea what's coming. His girlfriend realizes that we just hit an animal, but no one's really sure what it is yet. The music's off in the car at this point, and I step out. And at this moment, the adrenaline is just flowing because there's a good chance whatever animal we hit that's now lying in the ditch is really, really suffering. And you think you know how it's gonna end. As soon as I put my foot onto the asphalt, I look down the steep embankment, and this ditch, it's about 8 feet deep. At the top are all these large rocks, and at the bottom's a lot of tall grass and some shrubs. And that's when I see the animal we just hit. It's the cutest little baby deer with spots. And you think to yourself, oh my God, we just hit Bambi with a car. Well, sorry, I'm going to stop there for a second. I guess I don't need to say I was a naturalist at the time, do I? Okay. Oh, yeah, I can do that. Yep. At the time, I was working in Algonquin Park as a naturalist. So I know a thing or two about animal and automobile collisions. But, you know, there's no vets where we are. And its mom can't help it. You know, standing at the top of the ditch looking down, I really can't see what sort of injury the animal has. I can see that it's struggling to get up, and it's just floundering, and it's in a lot of pain, and it's making this god-awful noise. It's suffering. It's just absolutely scared. So I'm climbing down the ditch, which is a little bit precarious because of all these rocks. As I'm getting closer, what's going through my mind is like, this thing is in pain. That's all I could think, is this animal is in pain. And it just dawns on you. It's like, end its suffering. That's the only thing you have to do right now. I crawl down to the embankment and I made sure that it stopped moving. It's the only thing I could do. You know, for a moment, I was petting the animal's side, you know, because it was still warm, and I watched it stop breathing. By this time, Liam was standing beside me, and he was quiet. His girlfriend, who was still sitting in the passenger seat, but with the door open, she was crying. She just couldn't believe what had happened. And I just had to give myself a moment before I climbed out of the ditch and we all got back in the car, and it was really quiet. And eventually we started the car moving again. And it was a silent car ride, and we still had about another 20 kilometers to go to where I was living, because I was getting a ride home. I was in shock, I guess, for the most part, because you're still dwelling on the fact that you just killed this beautiful creature that should be alive running around the woods, just living life. The deer's story doesn't end in the ditch, in the dark. I borrowed a friend's car, and I drove back to the site of the accident, and I climbed back down to the ditch with a couple garbage bags, and I picked up the deer's carcass, put it into a garbage bag, drove it back home, and put it in the freezer. The next morning, I drove it to work, and there's a scientific specimen freezer at the Algonquin Park Visitor Center. That's where I was working. I put it in there, and I told everyone that it happened that I worked with, and they alerted the park. For the rest of the summer, the jokes were being laid down about me killing Bambi, and if there was other animals that I wanted to take out. You know, maybe there's a rabbit, so I could take out Thumper. Or maybe I want to step up a level and take out Bambi's mom. You know, a lot of people had a good time just, you know, making fun of me. So months go by, and we get to the end of winter, and an email shows up in my inbox. The title of the email said, "Your deer." Inside, there's a series of photographs that were sent to me by the park biologist at the time. She was dissecting the deer. For her, it was the first time for her to actually study anything like this up close. And the very last photograph was actually the pelt of the fawn. When I returned to the park that following summer, one of the first things that the chief park naturalist said to me, he said, "Hey, we're gonna have a really good year. We have a see and touch specimen table for park visitors to come look at. And one of the star features of that table is the pelt from my deer." Whew, I can tell you, yeah, I can tell you that I don't ever want to do that again. I'm the guy that I don't kill spiders in my house. I gently pick them up in a piece of Kleenex and I put them outside. It's not nice to do what I did. I could have walked away. Why didn't I? Why didn't I walk away? I think the people around me growing up always said not to let anyone or anything suffer. The right thing to do is exactly what I did. You know, that moment, I think it made me more human.
That's Tobin Long with an act of bravery that gave some measure of meaning and value to the death of an animal. He no longer works as a park naturalist, but continues to enjoy the outdoor life as much as he can. He's in Toronto. And that's Everyday Bravery Goes to Work. What's your everyday bravery story? Share it with me and with Prudential on social media. Just add the hashtag Everyday Bravery and tell us about your most courageous moments. I'm Meg Wilcox. May you be brave in your everyday life. And for those times you can't find the courage you need, be like Monica Ricketts. Try wishing upon a star. Everyday Bravery from Prudential. Bring your challenges.